Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. These podcasts are presented to help explore the impact of the longevity revolution on our congregations and our community. And we invite you to visit our website, jewishsacredaging.com, the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page, and leave a comment or a suggestion to me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And if you would like, you can go to the homepage and leave us a voice message that's available on the homepage of jewishsacredaging.com. And at this time, it gives us pleasure to welcome to the Seekers of Meaning microphone, Dr. Alan Herzlin. Doctor who holds a doctorate in counseling psychology, is a certified addictions professional by the Florida Certification Board and an internationally certified alcohol and drug counselor coming to us from beautiful Wellington, Florida. Hi, Alan. How you doing?
Hi, Rabbi. It's a great pleasure to talk to you and to be with you and to share information about this crucial subject with the Seekers of Meaning audience.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you being here. We've known each other for a while, so Richard's fine. And for full disclosure, I've known the good doctor from years of working with him on the board of the Union for Reform Judaism. But we're not here to talk about the Union for Reform Judaism. We're really talking about your dedication to work professionally in areas of addiction. And so let me start off with something that really speaks to our audience in many ways. I keep reading and have entered into some conversations with other professionals about this rather alarming or frightening or challenging, whatever word you want to use, rise in levels of addictions amongst baby boomers. And so you deal with this professionally. Is this true? And if so, why?
Well, I think we have to take a bit of a historical perspective with this. When I was thinking about our discussion today, I was thinking that when I got into this field some 45 years ago, you know, I was a young guy, and now I'm of that, certainly that boomer generation, having been born in 1947. So I've seen a whole long perspective of this. And in reading the history of drug abuse and alcohol abuse, you know, we can go way back to when there were huge levels of addiction in America. We'll talk about America. We remember with the opium wars and the opium addictions in the early 1900s in America. So it's not such an unusual phenomenon. It's been with us before. We shouldn't forget also that alcohol and alcoholism gets left out a lot of these discussions, which is a very, very big mistake, because among all levels of our society, alcohol abuse has been number one for as long as we can remember, taking so much of an effect in our national economy and in the homes of our people, no matter what their religious belief or circumstance happens to be. To address it very specifically, let's start out with talking about the boomer generation, for people born between 46 and 64, and people who started to reach their retirement age of 65 in 2011. And I was finding a statistic that amounts to about 76 million people in the United States, which is almost 30% of the population. Is there a rise in abuse and addiction? One of the things that we know over the last 15 to 20 years is that with the rise of pain medications, there has been a huge rise in the use of pain medications, either by prescription, which we call iatrogenic disease or doctor-induced. Not that doctors want to induce this disease, but when people are given prescriptions for pain medications and opiates, for pain reduction, addiction and dependence can happen somewhat rapidly. With the rise of these pain medications, either legal or illegal, we have invited into our society, in fact, it's really in all Western societies, a huge rise in what we call, you know, across addiction issues happening. People becoming dependent on the on pain relief medications, and really getting hooked. And so when we see on TV, as we've had so many exposés talking about poorer states such as West Virginia and places in Ohio and other places that have become, that have been financially depressed, that have become, you know, the opioid capitals of the United States, well, that it's really happening to that, not only to the boomers, but certainly younger people. So the basic underlying answer is that it is true that despite us seeing historical waves of addiction to alcohol, to opioids, to various substances, we are seeing it again. Not is it rising, it has risen. So we are not going towards it, we are already there. So that is certainly happening in, as I said, in the boomer generation, as people have more surgeries, as they live longer, as they begin to have more pain. Again, I'm not talking about alcohol in this. The elderly is a whole nother cohort that I'm sure that we want to get into with some specific questions. So I have a lot of thoughts about that.
Well, let's jump right into it. I mean, what's the difference? I mean, I know as I travel for Jewish Sacred Aging, one of the great fears of what I call the three major fears of issues around aging, one of them is this fear of being dependent and of having living with pain and suffering. And yet we have this rise, thank God, of this specialty of palliative care, which can manage pain and manage the suffering. But I would imagine what I'm hearing you say is that people become so dependent upon some of these issues, not necessarily the end of life, which is, I think, another whole sub conversation by itself. Do you think it's because we're just now in America so conditioned, or there is this pharmacological industrial complex that, I mean, you alluded to the stuff that's been on 60 Minutes and well documented in newspapers and other media. Are we at the mercy of this industrial pharmacological confluence that's really doing damage to us? What does it say about our society?
We are always looking for a way to feel better than we do. Some of us are fortunate enough to be able to have found methods of feeling better than the way we do through spirituality, through meditation, through relationships, good and healthy and wholesome relationships with other people, through enjoyment of life. But some people have found that the only way that they're going to feel better is by taking something into their system to change the way they think, feel, and act. And that is what is the bottom line behind, in my way of thinking, having been at this for a long, long time. That's what's behind a lot of this insidious addiction problem in our society. We're always looking for that better high. And no matter what drugs get outlawed, no matter what political football is played by the government in having wars on drugs and things like that, it seems like we as human beings are always looking for a way to feel better than we do. And sometimes this invites real disaster. Now, when it comes, just one more point, when it comes to the elderly, I know my father was a physician for many, many years. He was involved in this field. He was one of the pioneers in this field. That's how I got interested in it. But he can recall older people coming to his general medical practice and, you know, people who are, and I'm going back a lot of years, you know, people who are isolated from their families or dealing with loneliness, didn't have anybody to talk to. They go into the office and they would, you know, they would complain about this pain, that pain, the other pain. What my dad would tell me, he said, you know, they're suffering from a lack of love. They're suffering from a lack of relationship. So they're looking for something to feel better. And a lot of physicians, this is changing, but a lot of physicians didn't know what to do for them. So they gave them, you know, they gave them a Valium or a Librium or an Elavil, some kind of medication panacea to help them feel better because they didn't know what to do for them in their office.
It's interesting you mention that only because in the work, one of the workshops we do on health and wellness, there are these passages from Maimonides that your father was channeling, whether he knew it or not, about what a physician should be doing when somebody comes into their office. Before they deal with the pain, they need to do a whole, in essence, psychological workup of saying, really tell me what's going on in your life. And you allude to something that I was going to go to, but I want to jump into it now because you referenced it. That there seems to be this it's my perception that one of the challenges we face as a society right now, and part of the residuals of the longevity revolution, is this unbelievable rise in isolation, that many people living alone without any social contact, without anybody visiting them in a nursing home or an assisted living facility. But talk to me about how this isolation factor could open the door to substance abuse or alcoholism or types of addiction.
When people feel alone, especially people who are getting older in life, who are, let's say, beyond my age, people who are getting into their late 70s and into their 80s, and they've lost a spouse, their children live at a great distance, whom they talk to on the phone here and there, but of course never enough, Sonny dear, and come and visit them on occasion. Their social structure is pretty much destroyed. So they find themselves in a situation where they're looking at themselves in the mirror rather than other people to concentrate on. And they're getting depressed. Everything that they knew in their lives is no longer. So here they are, just, they don't know where to turn. They don't, their social construct has been taken from them. And they need something to feel better, and they start to feel ill. They really start to feel physically ill with different pains, with more headaches. So, and I've seen it for years where older people will start drinking just to feel better. They'll have a beer with maybe some people in the clubhouse or just a friend, or they'll start to drink alcohol, be it wine or beer or whiskey, whatever it happens to be, and it changes the way somebody thinks, feels, and acts. And so they start to increase their drinking, and after a time, they get to a point where indeed they need this to just feel at an even keel, to feel better. That's sometimes a very long process, and sometimes not very long. Or they get medication for relief of depression or medication from relief of physical pain. So they start to get into this this pattern of I'm taking a pill to feel better, to make me feel less depressed, to make me feel more with it so I can get along in my daily routine. And I have a couple of drinks later in the afternoon and, you know, it helps me feel better. It relaxes me. I'm able to watch TV or go to the clubhouse or to, you know, socialize with some friends, which doesn't happen very often. But then the isolation begins to happen more and more and more and more. One of the things I remember you saying a long time ago, which made so much sense to me, and it really hasn't happened as far as I know, for people who are living in these life communities, like my mother, may she rest in peace, lived for like 15 years, you know, here in Florida, very nice place. And, you know, the religious community, or in our situation, the Jewish religious community, needed to get a different idea of what a congregation meant, what a family of people meant, and what it means to people. And they needed to be in those places to invite people in, to draw near, so that they could develop a community of people who could share and study together and talk together and break through this whole wall of isolation. And it was a brilliant thought, and really needs to happen. So there are some of the things that I've seen over the years that have certainly happened to older people. And of course, there are many more things, but that's some of them. There's no doubt that the pill use and the alcohol use, as people live longer, goes up, especially when they're isolated and have lost their familial bonds.
In your experience of practice, and we're speaking with Dr. Alan Herzen, doctor of counseling psychology and certified addictions professional, been doing this for over four decades. Alan, in your experience, is there such a thing as an addictive personality?
It's a term that I've really wanted to stay away from. Many years ago, we didn't believe in any of that genetic jazz, you know?
Right.
But as we began to get more scientifically based in the addictions field, we began to see for sure that for many people, there is a definite genetic marker. Really? for being prone to drug and or alcohol abuse and addiction. We used to say that it runs in families. Those of us in the treatment field, we saw it all the time. And we used to tell people, without having any scientific evidence way back when, we would tell people that they would tell us, well, my grandfather was an alcoholic, my father was an alcoholic, I swore that it would never happen to me, and it did. We used to tell people that you have to teach your children to be very, very careful about what they drink, because this whole thing seems to run in families. And scientifically, the scientific field of the world has proven that there is a genetic predisposition for this. But it's certainly not true that everybody who becomes addicted had somebody in their family that was either alcoholic or drug addicted. So the answer is yes, there's a genetic predisposition for some of these things. But when it comes to a certain personality type, usually what we see, the personality changes when the abuse is actually happening or as it's developing. We see a change in a person's personality, in their behavior, in their interpersonal relationships, in the problems that they develop on the job with their spouse, with their children, with their families, with their workplace. So there are people that I've met in my life that you could never believe that they would ever have become alcoholic or drug addicted. And there are people that you could swear, oh, I know that that's going to happen to him or her, and it didn't. Wow. So I'm careful about the personality type stuff.
Are you seeing, I mean, you function a lot in the area of alcoholism and other addictions, but am I mistaken on maybe anecdotally seeing a rise in other types of addictions in right now in our society?
Well, a lot of them have become much more publicized than they were before. We certainly saw things about people who were harming themselves, people who were cutting themselves,
right.
That kind of behavior. Has that always been true? Probably, but it's been publicized. People are talking much more freely about these things. Is it more? I believe that it is more. We have people having an addiction. This may sound very strange, but I believe that some people have an addiction to stuff, that they have to have stuff. I'm not talking about hoarding, but people, instead of having a quality of life or love in their life or good relationships, they're hooked on getting stuff. Certainly, we're familiar with food addiction. Mm-hmm. We're familiar with gambling addiction,
right.
and consequent treatment programs and self-help groups to work on those things. I would just say when it comes to the idea of cutting or self-harming or things like that, I go back to the early 80s when I helped write an article for 17 magazine. That's how old I'm getting. And it talked about kids and drinking and kids in high school and college with using other drugs as well, way back in those days of the Punic Wars. And we knew that it was happening then. But what we see now, and talk to any counselors that work in any university here or in Canada, and you will see that the counseling centers in colleges and universities are absolutely overwhelmed by kids coming with depression, with suicidal thoughts, with fear that they can't even get along, that they're going to fail, that they're it's an epidemic. And what does this spell for substance abuse and addiction? It's a very dangerous precursor to this. These kids are going to have to find a way to feel better if they're not getting there by therapy or even some very excellent pharmacology that we have now used in the right way. So we have the clarion call is for young people today that are so stressed. They're so stressed out. They're such high levels of depression. And stressed out young people make for stressed out and depressed boomers, become stressed out and depressed elderly too. So this is another offshoot of something that is a real serious horror in the making for our societies.
Yeah, I remember from some of the work we did in the department when I worked for the URJ, and the other thing is, you're alluding to what I think a lot of people don't understand. This is really a systemic family. It's a family systems issue.
No doubt.
It's not just the 19-year-old or the 89-year-old. It really is a family systems issue, which leads me to something that I wanted to explore with you that was triggered by a recent article in the Washington Post from in March that talks about grandparents. Since a lot of us are members of the grandparenting club, but this rise, and I'm interested if you see it in your work, this rise in grandparents who are now, because of their adult children having to deal with addiction issues and substance abuse issues, are in their 70s or late 60s or 70s or early 80s now becoming very active parents to their grandchildren because that generation is missing. And that's one of the, so are you seeing that? Yeah. I have a follow-up to that when you're.
Yes, the answer is yes, absolutely. In fact, all you have to do is watch what I consider a really excellent program called Intervention. It's on TV. It's a really interesting real-life series And this is exactly something you see an awful lot, where the grandparents have to take over the role of the parent of the parent for the grandchildren, because the parent is absent, oftentimes divorced, oftentimes just blatantly alcoholic or drug addicted, and can't even function as a parent. This is happening a lot.
So the follow-up then is really, because clergy deal with this, you know, from an essence of, from, you know, from our perspective, but from your perspective as the clinician, talk to me about how you would work with with grandparents who have to deal with their grandchildren, who may be dealing with issues of addiction, and what does that mean? Because I'm sure it raises all kinds of concerns and fears. You know, how long am I going to be alive? What's going to happen to my grandchild who's dealing with this horrible issue? What can I do? But I can't do anything.
Well, there are a couple of ways of this. As I was just saying, there are grandparents who are having to take the role of the parent because their children are dealing with their own addiction problems, and the grandparents are having to take the role of the parents with the grandchildren, or the grandchildren with the grandparents are having to watch their grandchildren suffer through their own addiction issues. So, which way did you want to take?
All of the above.
Oh, okay. All of the above.
Sort of like a PhD thesis in 5 minutes.
Yeah, really. When grandparents are having to deal with a grandchild that is going through an addiction issue, if the parent or parents are stable, and the parents are the ones that are pulling out their hair, and the grandparents may be the only stable force in that family constellation. The grandparents need to get material to understand the addiction process and what happens in the family during that whole process. I would certainly advise them that they should, whichever way it goes, whether it's the grandchildren or their own child that is having an addiction problem, that they should get themselves to a self-help group for relatives of addicts. For instance, like in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has a program there's a program for families called Al-Anon, which is excellent. There are many local treatment centers that have family programs to educate the other family members about the nature of the addiction, what they can do and what they can't do. So the first thing is that instead of going off half-cocked and throwing out all kinds of gauntlets to the addicted person, be it a child or a grandchild, they have to know the parameters of the disease and really what power and resources they have to do with fighting it. That's the first thing. After that, then it becomes a matter of learning to pick and choose where a grandparent is going to intervene. Again, if it's with a grandchild, the first entree has to be to the hopefully more stable parent and join them in this learning process. I've seen that be very, very effective so that everybody in the family gets on the same page. Without everybody being on the same page as to what they know, the information that they know, and what they are prepared to do about it, if everybody is singing different tunes, nothing is ever going to happen correctly. So that's been the process that I've followed over all these years for family members. And the family members can be very influential, you know, in this situation, as long as everybody's on the same page and they know what they're doing.
In your experience, Alan, what's the role? Because you've painted these pictures, but what's the role of faith or spirituality in dealing with these issues of addictions within families, multi-generationally or without it. But do you see any, do you see a role of this? Do you see people who have a more a reliance on faith or spirituality being a better able to cope with issues? It's a question that comes up a lot. And what's been your experience?
First of all, I am very, very glad to say that especially in our synagogues, that more and more synagogues, clergy people are making it their business to become educated about addiction. In the old days is, you know, this isn't really our problem.
Oh, yes, right.
You know,
right.
Heck, I was doing a program 30 years ago in synagogues called Jews and Booze.
Right.
You know, taking off the blinders and seeing that it's there. In my own synagogue, and everybody can point to this, we've had, I can right now think of three young people and one older person who's committed suicide because of their addiction situation. And that's in a synagogue of 330 households. So you can imagine that rabbis and cantors are learning about this issue, speaking about it in a free way before their congregations and in their newsletters, that lets people know that this is a human condition, that it's addressable by our synagogue. We want to be of help, and that they're available for people to talk. Look, some people will go right away to therapists. Some people will go right away to their rabbi or to their cantor to have that talk. And then that clergy person has a wonderful role to play in helping hear these people, let them know that it's okay, it's human, it's not shameful, it's a human health problem, and that there are ways that we can refer you to get help to start to get some healing here. And that's also good for young people, very good for young people to hear this, because in our synagogues, we have to, as Maimonides taught, we have to deal with the entire human being. Our spiritual need is our human need. And part of our humanness is our suffering as well as our joy.
This, the conversation, and I've talked to, I'm sure you've dealt with this all the time, and just about every colleague I know in the course of his or her career has gotten a call dealing with a family in crisis. A lot of times with a younger person, a lot of times the call will come in from a grandparent, and that my loved one needs a treatment facility. It, one of the things, and I hope you're going to correct me and tell me that I'm totally wrong, but there just seems to be a shortage of freestanding Jewish-oriented facilities to treat addictions in the United States of America and Canada. Am I wrong or am I right?
Let me read you something from today's Palm Beach Post.
Ah.
So, Florida is not a shining light when it comes to healthcare solutions or taking care of those who need the social safety net the most. We rank 40th among states in per capita spending for mental health and 41st for drug addiction treatment. So I'm going to answer your question in a couple of different ways. Years ago, it used to be far easier for people to get drug and alcohol treatment. We had much more insurance coverage.
Far easier? Is that what you said?
Far easier before, years ago.
Wow.
Yes, far easier. There are many companies had employee assistance programs. They followed the employee assistant model, where people who were suspected of having an addictive disease were referred to the EAP to be evaluated rather than fired and be brought to treatment. My treatment center in New York dealt with a whole range of employee assistance programs, from airlines to the New York City Transit Police Department, and had people referred, you know, all the time. A lot of this has gone by the wayside. Insurance companies has closed up a lot of their access. There are reasons for that, which we're not going to go into. We're not going to go into now. So treatment, really good professional treatment, has become much more expensive and much harder to get. Hence, there are a lot of charlatans in this field, as we know, certainly down here in South Florida, with the revelations over the past few years. So that's one part. So treatment is definitely harder to get when you talk about, let's say, Jewishly oriented treatment facilities. There certainly are very, very few. I'm not sure that religiously oriented treatment facilities are necessarily the best model to follow, but that's a different discussion.
Right.
But it definitely is harder for people to get competent help.
And despite the fact that it's more talking about it, there seems to be more awareness of it. You're saying that there's more awareness and less organizational or governmental support,
or in business. I just mentioned the
EAP,
the employees, which was huge throughout this country. That has, in so many instances, just gone by the wayside. So people get fired instead of getting helped.
Is this all a matter of economics, that insurance companies are cutting the bottom line or looking at the bottom line?
Well, I think actually, in one sentence, what happened is that a lot of treatment programs that were psychiatric facilities, they just really raped the insurance system.
Wow.
Because I have this perspective of 45 years back, so they put into effect the managed care system, first in psychiatric and in substance abuse facilities, which kept people either out of treatment, put them first in outpatient treatment where they had to fail either once, twice, or three times in order to get into inpatient treatment. But now with the opioid crisis going on, the addiction is very deep, very long, very, very hard, very difficult. And putting somebody in the treatment center for 30 days doesn't do the trick. So we talk about it, addictions and alcoholism has been a political football forever, and it continues to be the same, unfortunately.
So before we close, just there may be a grandmom or a grandpop or a clergy person listening to this whenever they do and will say, can you give me a website that I can go to at least begin the process of getting some help or understanding, because I'm at a loss for words. Is there such a website or a key site that somebody can look at and begin to?
I would say, especially for the family member.
Yeah.
The family member. I would, without picking up one, do a search. Alcoholism and substance abuse treatment centers, and put in your zip code, and find a treatment center that has a family program where they have a family information program. Forget the addict at that point, right? So that you can get knowledge and information and guidance as to what you as a family member can do. And there are things, instead of just feeling desperate and just locked into your own world and living the life of the addict, which is what happens to family members, you can learn through the experience, strength, and help and professionalism of others about how you can start to change. You can change the dialogue in this discussion. So that would be the first thing that I would do. And for clergy people, if they haven't done so already, to organize with other clergy people in their communities to have like in-service education if they don't have it through their own religious denominational group, to have in-service education from experts about the whole issues of alcoholism and other substance abuses, so that they will know how to deal with it, not to treat it, but how to deal with it. And to open it up to their congregations so that people will feel less shame about going to talk to their clergy person about this, to make it okay and a good thing to come in and start dealing with it.
Dr. Alan Herzen, knowledge, information, and guidance. It's a good mnemonic, K-I-G, knowledge, information, and guidance. A good place to end a fascinating conversation, just the beginning, and hopefully we can continue this in a variety of different formats. Alan, thank you very, very much for your time and your expertise, and most of all, your passion in this, because it's quite obvious. So thank you for everything you've done and will do, and Hatzlacha, take care, and hope to see you soon when I get back down there. So take care.
Always a pleasure, Richard. Be well.
Thank you. And thank all of you for listening to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. And again, we welcome your comments to rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com and invite you to visit our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. These podcasts are recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and produced by Steve Lubetkin. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you for listening. Todah and Shalom.